Informal Observations 3, The Floor. And now, your hosts, Michael Sonbert and Antonio Vance.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to a brand new episode of Informal Observations, Season 3, The Floor. If you don't know what The Floor is, you got to listen to Episode 1. Find out. It's Michael Sonbert, founder and CEO of Skyrocket Education, here as always with the good doctor, Dr. Antonio Vance. Antonio, what's up, man?
Not too much. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're doing a for our listeners, we're doing a morning edition. This is Breakfast with Skyrocket. we're supposed to do the other night as we normally do, and we both texted each other that we were both absolutely fried, and so this is the morning edition. So Vance, are you a big like kegs and eggs guy? Are you like not obviously during the work day, but when you're on vacation, are you a guy who'll do like a beer or a mimosa with your eggs, with your omelet? Or are you like, nah, man, that's strictly for the afternoon and evening and then late into the night?
Yeah, I can't do the, no, I'm, I eggs and no, I'm a traditional breakfast guy. If I even do eat breakfast, I'm a coffee, get the day started. You know, maybe if it's a late like brunch or something, I'm on vacation, but nah, yeah. Mornings are coffee and water. Let's go.
Yeah, I always, it's funny when I see people drinking like mimosas at like 9 or 10 a.m. And I'm like, in my mind, I think that they're going to be asleep by the time it's, you know, noon. At least I would be. So I'm with you. Folks, welcome. This is episode 2. And we're calling this Season the Floor. It's actually coaching that was given to me by my wife, and we talked about like what makes you all different, and it's the idea that we are actually in schools on the floor, in classrooms, walking side by side with leaders, where so many people in our space, and this is not a knock on them, it's not meant to be an us versus them, but so many people in our space are writing books from universities and are a million miles away from what's actually happening in classrooms. And I was at I was at a conference last year, and a researcher from Brown University was there presenting to us, and he'd done a study around how much time is actually wasted in schools. Wasted is the wrong term. How much time is spent on non-academic activities, things like assemblies and lunches and recess. And don't get me wrong, there's benefit to all that stuff, but he was just like, wanted to study how much time is spent on things in school that aren't actually instructionally focused. And the amount of time was staggering. And even things like transitions, which we would all agree are necessary, but how much actual instructional time is in an average school day? And so, and I don't remember the numbers, so I don't want to misquote him, but it was when you looked at it and saw how little instructional time is actually happening throughout the course of the day, it was pretty mind-blowing. And so at the happy hour that night, he and I were talking, and I said, hey, did you factor in anything like an entry routine that should take 30 seconds, but takes 4 minutes, handing in homework that should take, you know, 90 seconds, but takes 6 minutes, a direct instruction, for instance, that should take, or explicit instruction that should take 5 minutes, but takes 14, a do now review that should take 4 minutes, but takes 23. And it was like when a fish jumps out of the water and like sees the world around, like, it's something that he never even thought of. And here's this brilliant researcher from, you know, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, in our country, who had never even thought of these things. And it really was a reminder for me, not that it's competition, but that you and I are seeing the work so much differently than so many people, because I'd argue that the biggest wastes of time and the biggest pulls from instruction in schools are the things that I just described.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is that when you put that mirror up to folks and allow them to see all of the things that when folks get stuck in their tradition and every day, that things that have quote unquote worked before, and putting that mirror up is, I love it. I love it when it happens, when that fish out of water look happens, I'm like, yep, got
Yeah.
it. That's what we're here for. So
Yeah.
love it.
Well, I know it's funny. I was in a school. I think we have a reputation of being like mean and being jerks or in schools, and I think that that's mostly overblown. But I was in this one teacher's class for a while, and they were doing nothing, and doing more nothing, and doing more nothing, and then it was time for a brain break, and now the kids are up and they're dancing. Little kids, up dancing to some video on the smart board, and we left. And the school leaders found like there was no, they thought it was like, this is what school is. And I was like, what's the brain break from? What is a break has to imply that there was a break implies that there was something before it that was
Yeah.
rigorous or strenuous or that required some level of endurance. And so now we're taking a break, like when you lift a lot of weights and then you take a break between sets. Like you don't just like take you don't walk around the gym on your phone and then sit down and take a break, or at least if you do, you're not going to get any results. And so
Right.
it's just that it's that idea of us being able to hopefully see things in a way that that a lot of people don't, at the risk of sounding immodest, where there's lots of things that we're bad at. One of the things we're really good at is knowing how schools should run and knowing how to help people run their schools. So that being said, folks, and I mentioned this in episode one, we are doing this also live on YouTube. Very funny, from the first episode, you all wouldn't know this, but we got on camera and Antonio said to me, I thought we were doing this on video, because he disapproved of what I was wearing. My wardrobe did not meet his standards. So I'm dressed, I have a collar and a little polo, a little black polo on today. To make sure that I meet the visual standards. And our new format, it's not radically different, but we'll always start with a hot topic, or even a topic that we just find interesting. I'll bring up the subject to Dr. Vance, and he'll choose a side to argue. I will argue for the other side, and then we'll talk about one topic per episode. Today's topic I'm excited to get into. Before we get there, let's talk about the hot topic. The thing I'd like you to take a side on, Dr. Vance, is whether or not lesson plan sharing, so meaning on like a fourth grade team at a school, this has to be a school that has multiple teachers who teach the same grade, that one teacher would plan the math, one teacher would plan the ELA, one teacher would plan the science, and then they would simply share those resources with each other. So we're calling that, lesson plan sharing. There might be a more formal term for it. Dr. Vance, choose a side. Do you think this is a good thing or a not so good thing? Choose your side and then argue for it like your life depends on it.
Well, I think it will be very easy to argue against it.
Okay.
And I'm going to take that side and let you take the hard part, because I don't think that I'm sure there are some positives. I would say the idea of lesson planning as a whole is shifting. And I've seen lots of schools start to shift away from the traditional idea of lesson planning and more to intellectual prep. And so the idea that I used to hear when I first started teaching, your lesson plan should be so clear that anyone can walk in, grab those lesson plans, and teach the lesson. And rarely do we see folks planning to that extent. Currently, also curricula currently come with lots of those things. I believe that group less. I think that idea of like group lesson planning is really tough and challenging, because if I create an ELA lesson a certain way or a science lesson, it may not have the nuance that really reflect you as an educator, and your students are unique to you. So I feel like it's just double work, because once that person creates it, then you have to go in and then adjust it based on your students, where your standards progressions are, where your knowledge and abilities lie, and if it's your personality. I think that actually spending time diving into a topic and looking at things that are more important, which are, how is this standard, how is this connected to a standard? How am I going to check for misconceptions? What am I going to do when students don't get it? How am I assessing and checking for understanding and solidifying the learning? I find that to be difficult to do in a group shared lesson plan model.
Oh, what a compelling argument. And I agree. I actually agree with you 100%. I hate it. And now I have to argue for it.
Argue for it,
The
but like your
argument
life
for the
depends on
argument
it.
the argument for it is if when done well, and I can't think of one instance ever where I've seen it done well, but when done well, it lightens a teacher's load, theoretically. If you and I operate so synergistically as grade team or as grade teammates, and I know the way you think and you know the way I think, and you present this week's math plans for me, math lessons, and we've worked so closely together that I don't have to do a ton of internalization, and I could just over read through it and then present it. It saves time in terms of planning. I also do believe, as critical as I am of this model, that one of the real flaws in our field is how siloed people are, and how there might be somebody literally, on the other side of a 5, the 4-inch thick wall, who's doing some really amazing things that we never find out about. And so there's something to be said for me learning from you and you learning from me, just by way of what we've planned.
Absolutely.
But so it's a hard argument to make. I don't like it. I don't like it, because I've found that it's really hard to internalize something that somebody else created. And a lot of times we're in schools where we see somebody presenting material and it looks like it's the first time they've ever seen it. And then we find out that they're not actually the one who created it. And it might be in reality the first time they've ever seen it, maybe the second time. But I don't think that's what's best for kids. So I'm trying to make the argument for it, but it's very hard.
I mean, I also think if you're in a very low-resourced school environment, and you have built in the time and ability for teachers to be able to create, outlines and scopes. And I also think it's about the purpose. I rarely have seen where lesson planning actually is, the actual plan. I've usually see it as just a checkbox item. I do this because I have to. When I was a teacher, I often copied and pasted the same lesson plan, over and over again, because sorry if my AP back in the day listens to this, but they were
They
overwhelmed
weren't
and they
reviewing
weren't,
it, yeah.
they didn't have time to do it. I already knew what I was going to teach, how I was going to teach it. And it just became one of those routines where I just copied and pasted and submitted so I could get that checkbox. I do think if you have a new teacher that is new to teaching, that type of and a more seasoned teacher is working with them and helping them plan and to understand how to execute a lesson, I think that there could be a position and a place for especially a year 0 to 2 teacher where that could be beneficial.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I did the same thing as a teacher as well. I cut and pasted. The lesson plans were due Thursday at 5 p.m. for the following week. I cut and pasted things that sounded good, and then the night before, I created what I was going to do. Don't do what we did, folks. But we both did it, and actually, it kind of worked out. So, just a final point on this. I think it's I've found that some of the hardest stuff to edit, you and I just wrote a book together, which I'll talk about at the end of the show. As brilliant of a writer as you are, I found that some of the hardest work was to like deconstruct some of the stuff that you wrote, and then to add my voice to it. And I worry, and this goes for shared lesson planning, but even just curriculum in general, when it's provided for you, it could almost be a default to say, well, it's done. You can't do, you could potentially get away with that one lesson on a Thursday in October, when your students are 8 and you're like, actually, I'm looking at this for the first time, and I just had my formal, and my principal's not coming in today. I know that. It's much harder to do that with a book that thousands and thousands of people are going to read. And so I've found that, like, it's really hard. And I've, even with my own writing, when I've written something and then I have to go back in and revise it, this just happened. I submitted a piece. So I won't mention the publication because they might not publish it, but they had revisions for me, and it took me a week to go back into my own writing to go back in and revise it because it just felt so daunting. And so I think when something's already created, it feels much less accessible than when it's just a blank space. I don't think I'm the only one who thinks that.
Unless it's
Vance,
AI.
what did you say?
Unless it's AI.
AI is actually pretty easy to revise, right? Dr. Vance, today's topic, I said tonight, today's topic, early morning, sun shining bright. Dr. Vance, does anybody do restorative justice well? I understand there's been a shift over the last, decade, and in some ways it's pendulum swung back in the last couple of years. But, I've been hearing for a decade about restorative justice, longer probably, and I've never really seen it done well. What I've seen is folks who say that they're a restorative justice school, but there's almost no evidence of that, or schools who do try, instead of kind of when a student doesn't meet expectations, instead of a punishment, a consequence, they do try to get students to restore and repair the harm they've done, and that all it does is lead to added teacher stress. What is perceived as a lowering of the bar by students. I used to get in trouble. Now I just have to say I'm sorry. And so theoretically, I couldn't be more aligned with an idea. And I've never really seen it in the way that it's been described. What are your thoughts on restorative justice?
Yeah, I think the whole suite of restorative practices and the ideas behind them, and like you said, the theory are absolutely compelling, right? They are the bedrock of like how things should in the world should happen. I wish we did restorative practices worldwide. The problem is execution is just wildly uneven, especially in schools. And when you add in now, as you mentioned, briefly, like there's like a political charge around it. And what starts to happen is that there's just this loss of an understanding and the consistency. And now it's just performative. People take restorative practices like it's plug and play. Like, hey, we do circles. We do the five restorative questions. When in fact, restorative practice is a culture. It's a mindset. It's not a checklist of things to do. It is a belief. And I think the places where I see that, where I've seen restorative practice and restorative justice work, are places where it is embedded in culture, where we believe that people believe deserve a second chance. We work with a school that says like part of their mantra is every day is a new day. So yesterday I had a bad day and this thing happened. Tomorrow's a new day. And they don't just say it. They do it. They practice it. They believe it. And so I think the major issue that you've seen are folks that say they're restored. I mean, it's just like what we often, talk about. Folks say, hey, I'm a project-based learning school, because we did a project this semester, right? That doesn't mean
Yeah.
that you have woven in, integrated those beliefs.
Yeah.
And it just requires so much more than just saying it and even doing some of the practices. It is the actual cultural part that you have to do way before you even start to introduce the ideas of restorative practices.
When we worked at Mastery Charter Schools in Philadelphia, I'm trying to think of the year. I think it was 2000, maybe 2012, or maybe it was 2013. But I remember that there was this push away from what's often called the no excuses model, which is actually that idea has been perverted. No excuses initially started as, hey, no excuses for adults. You've got to get children to succeed. And then for people who were really anti, like that kind of progressive charter movement, it became, no excuses for kids. If we say you have to wear a black belt and you're wearing a dark brown belt, you're getting sent home for the day. And
Right.
so I understand why there was lots of negative backlash around that idea. But we, as an organization, made a move away from that kind of more no excuses-ish model to a restorative model.
Yeah.
And we started as an academic team in January of the previous year, putting systems in place for the following August, or for the
Yeah.
upcoming August. So 8 months in advance. 8 months of training, 8 months of systems design, 8 months of rehearsal, 8 months
Yeah.
of conversations and rationale, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it backfired immensely
Yeah.
because you got to the school where you first taught, a school like Simon Gratz in North Philadelphia, which at one time was, I believe, the most violent school in the state or most dangerous school in the state of Pennsylvania, or right up there.
Top three.
Top three, right? And 6'5" high school senior would tell a teacher to go F themselves. And instead of an immediate consequence, and this is what's happening, a conversation started of like, hey, like that hurt my feelings. And like, why did you say that to me?
Right.
And that kids, first, even in a place like Mastery, where every last T was crossed and every last I was dotted. Even students were like it didn't land. And I get
Yeah.
that there's probably within that something huge to unpack around culture where punishment and you're bad and you're wrong becomes so ingrained that conversations about, hey, look, let's talk about that impact, are so new and so different that folks just don't respond well to it. And I'm not putting it on the kids here, but what I'm saying is, like, even with that much planning,
Yep.
it went incredibly poorly across the board. And we see folks who on, August 19th are like, hey, kids are coming back in a week. Guess what? We're now a restorative justice school.
Yep.
No training and no research and no reading and no modeling and no coaching for deans. We write about in our new book how deans in schools are almost entirely left alone.
Yeah.
That doesn't bode well for this model, in my opinion, man. What do you, even if I philosophically agree with it, even when I talk to my own children and I'm like, hey, you know we don't do that. Why should, like, let's have a conversation about
Yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Please go apologize to your sister about that. And that's much better than you don't get to watch TV for a week, which doesn't really work.
Yeah.
But that doesn't bode well for the model, considering it went so poorly back then, right?
Yeah, I think that I think that part of some of the struggles, I mean, there were lots of things, because one, you have this like compliance driven rollout, which sometimes feels top down.
Yeah.
Restorative practice has to be bottom up, right? Because you have to get that buy-in and that belief from the
Okay.
folks that are where it's happening at, right? Not, we don't apply restorative practices on top of people, right? It should start from that community.
Yeah.
And with such a, and starting with a such a large organization, you have inconsistent application across the board.
Okay.
And then you have what I've seen a lot of times in schools is this like extreme swing, right? We are a totally restorative practice, so that now there are there are no consequences for things. We're just going to have a conversation, as you mentioned earlier, where restorative practices is very clear in their philosophy around, no, we bound, like there's a punitive consequence still, right? But there's also a restorative consequence as well. So you have to partner those things really well. If you look at some of the most, at some of the top prison systems, they use these restorative practices in prisons across the country because they spent time building that culture. But also, like, there's also a punitive part to it where you're still gonna have a, like, oh crap, I shouldn't have did that. And paired with, like, also, we have a community here. We have to live together. We have to eat together. Let's figure out how to move past this in a reflective way. And so the places and schools where I see this successful have partnered those two things really well, that when you do X thing, you're still have a consequence, right? We're not going to swing too far to, you know, the one side. So I think, again, it takes more than 8 months to build those undergirding community norms, and the things that build that solid relational foundation. And it takes a lot of training, a lot of time. It's a heavy lift. It is not something that you just plug into a school. You have to really start from the beginning and build up.
Yeah, great points. Two things I'd love you to reflect on or respond to, rather. I am probably the two people in the world who are least interested in any school leaders telling us they don't have enough time to do things are you and me. And not that time is not in short supply in schools, it is. But that mostly the lack of time, or at least a large part of it, is based on incomplete systems, lack of clarity or lack of role clarity, everybody kind of doing everything, a walkie-talkie, and now three people run to the thing. And that when you start to actually deconstruct what's happening in schools, you learn that so much of time is being wasted on just really like poor implementation and you know, like unclear systems. So when people tell me they don't have enough time, I always look at it sideways. But I do think that there's a time component here that is worth mentioning, where when it's simply a you're out of the classroom, you're in the dean's office, you know, there's a call home and it's done or whatever it is, that is a faster process. And in some ways, an easier process than writing a letter. Let's analyze what happened. Let's talk about your emotions. Who do you need to repair harm with? And that some of why I think this goes mostly poorly is because of the time that it takes to do it well. And then the second thing I'm going to ask you to reflect on is in your example of the pendulum having swung so far that there are now no consequences, that teachers, and we love our teachers, but that teachers don't, that they feel like they haven't gotten, that students haven't gotten sufficient consequence, that they haven't, the teacher wants their pound of flesh. For those folks just listening, Antonio's laughing here. The folks on YouTube will see it, but like that, they haven't gotten their pound of flesh because this student has been a pain in my ass for 3 months. And every time it happens, the dean takes them out and then they bring them back and they give me a half-hearted, I'm sorry. And then it's right back to the thing. And how can I teach in that environment? So, I'm not saying, by the way, I don't think the teacher should think that way, but I understand when it feels like there are no consequences. I do understand why they might pick one or pick both, but the time aspect to do this well, and then teachers feeling like nothing happened. Michael's been acting this way for weeks. Nothing's happening, and that's frustrating for folks.
This is a thing I talk about often with leaders, and I see it happen all the time when I'm sitting with leaders and a student does X thing, and a teacher or someone else could be just like, why is that student not suspended? Or why are they, X, Y, or Z? And part of this goes back to people need this, like restorative practices needs an entire, like, philosophical mindset and educational component, right? When you start to understand the juvenile brain and how the brain changes over time in children, and for children that aren't that could have been exposed to trauma and all of these things, like teachers sometimes set that to the side, and in order for restorative practices to actually to work, there has to be this ideological shift in folks, which is the thing that takes a long time. And so back to that time part, and connected to this, folks have to understand that restorative practices assumes, right, that people have hearts and emotions, and that students don't wake up that morning to like cause hell in your school, to be disrespectful to you. We don't come to school every, day to be disruptive and stop learning, right? And so we assume that about our children. We understand that they come with the weight of whatever happens outside of our walls, or and what is happening, years ago. They bring that in, and so a lot of it is a response. And so when we think about the time that we spend, we have to make sure that we are understanding that time sitting, reflecting, asking those questions, those restorative questions around, like, how did it make you feel when this thing happened? Right? And really pulling at folks' internal, like, humanity. And so restorative practices assumes and hopes that, right, that is inside of that child. And t after time, those reflections will and do have an impact, depending on where you are and the type of things that need to be restored in your particular environment. It takes time. It's not a one shot, first time that you did a reflection, all right, I'm a great kid now, right? But over time, when children build that understanding, as their brain develops a certain way, that their strength that starts to build, and understanding that builds over time. I've seen it done well. I've done restorative practices in schools that I've led, and I've seen some of the toughest students over time start to recognize, like, okay, I do have a place here. My voice is being heard. I do have an impact. This community actually does care about me, and I can tell you stories, even at Gratz, where, like, I'm not going to get emotional now, but I could if I tell the story, where those circles have had impact on some of the toughest kids out there. But it requires, I can't emphasize it enough, immense amount of training. It is a heavy lift. It is a tremendous amount of work. So if you're a school out there saying that you are a restorative practice school, I would love to come see and see the things that are happening, and not as a critique, but as a push, because and hopefully also to learn, because it is really, really tough. And if you ever want to know a school that's doing it well, I can also refer some schools to you at well. So happy to reach out and talk to anyone that's interested in talking more about it.
I know, man. I like the sales pitch at the end. That was cool. I dig it. What a one final thought that I had is to do this well, people have to see the good and the potential and the
Yes.
possibility in their students.
Yep.
And sometimes when a student is causing all types of you know what in class, and in a hallway or in a lunchroom, the opposite occurs from the adults,
Yeah.
which is, by the way, probably a natural emotion. Now, if my
Yeah.
neighbor was always throwing rocks at my window, I probably wouldn't like them very much. But
Yeah.
as educators, we don't have that luxury of just saying, well, that person's an a-hole or whatever it is. We actually have to be like, oh, I have to work harder in this situation. I have to do better. And so that's, I think, for some adults, there's a level of like letting go of ego, letting go of pride.
Yes.
I'm
Yep.
now going to talk to Michael, who I'm going to try and like connect with Michael when he's been this absolute nightmare, and my job would be so much easier if he just wasn't in my class. And now I'm supposed to do more and I'm supposed
Yep.
to do extra. And then I believe that that's a philosophical place that some folks are, or not even
That's
philosophical, yes, but almost like a level of discomfort that folks are not necessarily willing to embrace. And so
Ed, we just put out an article this week reflecting on that, that that is one of the number one burnout vectors for teachers is dealing with student behavior and that ongoing student discipline problems. Restorative practices is certainly an amazing tool. And again, it's a tool in the tool belt. It's not the magic wand. It's part of a collection of tools that schools need to use and can use to value their students and be equitable. But it does require that mindset shift to inherently believe in the good of your students, even though sometimes they don't believe in it themselves.
Well, on that note, folks, we're going to wrap it up. We hope that you like spending time hearing us chat, but beyond that, that you learn a little something, because I just learned the term burnout vector, which I've never heard before. And so I am going to use that all the time now. I think I might start a band called Burnout Vector.
Yo,
Folks, we have a new
I
book coming out on June 25th. Not sure when this is going to come out, this episode, probably right before then. It's called Unshakable Leadership, 21 Strategies for Success in Urban Schools and Beyond. I nailed it this time.
love it.
This in episode one, I struggled with our subtitle. But really, it's like, what do our most struggling schools need to do? Get away from the theoretical, get away from the, like just these ideas that, I don't know if I said this in episode one, so if I'm being redundant, I apologize, but the stuff that sounds like people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, and we're like, bullshit, that doesn't mean anything. And so let's actually have a great school and let's do these 21 things. And if they also think you care about them, that's great. One of our 21 strategies is building relationships. So we do value that, but we're trying to get away from noise and platitudes and just education jargon and get to the real meat of what makes a good school. Check out Unshakable Leadership. Thanks for hanging out with us on Informal Observations. I'm Michael for Dr. Vance. We'll see you all next time. Peace.
You've been listening to Informal Observations 3, The Floor. We'll catch you in the next episode.